presidents, respectively, of the ANC, the Transvaal Indian Congress, and the Natal Indian Congress, signed the Doctors' Pact, agreeing to join forces against a common enemy. This was a significant step toward the unity of the African and Indian movements. Rather than create a central political body to direct all the various movements, they agreed to cooperate on matters of common interest. Later, they were joined by the APO, the African People's Organization, a colored organization. But such an agreement was at best tentative, for each national group faced problems peculiar to itself. The pass system, for example, barely affected Indians or coloreds. The Ghetto Act, which had prompted the Indian protests, barely affected Africans. Colored groups at the time were more concerned about the race classification and job reservation, issues that did not affect Africans and Indians to the same degree. The Doctors' Pact laid a foundation for the future cooperation of Africans, Indians, and coloreds. Since it respected the independence of each individual group, but acknowledged the achievements that could be realized from acting in concert. The Doctors' Pact precipitated a series of non-racial anti-government campaigns around the country, which sought to bring together Africans and Indians in the freedom struggle. The first of these campaigns was the first Transvaal and Orange Free State People's Assembly for Votes for All, a campaign for the extension of the franchise to all black South Africans. Dr. Thuma announced ANC participation at a press conference over which I presided. At the time, we believed the campaign would be run by the ANC, but when we learned that the ANC would not be leading the campaign, the Transvaal Executive Committee decided that the ANC should withdraw. My idea at the time was that the ANC should be involved only in campaigns that the ANC itself led. I was more concerned with who got the credit than whether the campaign would be successful. Even after the withdrawal, Ramahone, the president of the Transvaal region of the ANC, issued a press statement calling on Africans in the province to take part in the campaign of Votes for All, in clear contravention of the decision of the Transvaal Executive Committee. This was an act of disobedience the committee could not tolerate. At a conference called to resolve this dispute, I was asked to move a no-confidence motion against Ramahone for his disobedience. I felt an acute conflict between duty and personal loyalty, between my obligations to my organization and to my friend. I well knew that I would be condemning the action of a man whose integrity and devotion to the struggle I never questioned, a man whose sacrifice in the liberation struggle was far greater than my own. I knew that the action that he called for was, in fact, a noble one. He believed that Africans should help their Indian brothers. But the seriousness of Ramahone's disobedience was too strong. While an organization like the ANC is made up of individuals, it is greater than any of its individual parts, and loyalty to the organization takes precedence over loyalty to an individual. I agreed to lead the attack, and offered the motion condemning him, which was seconded by Oliver Tambo. This caused an uproar in the House, with verbal battles between those in the region who supported their president and those who were on the side of the executive. The meeting broke up in disorder. Chapter 13. Africans could not vote, but that did not mean that we did not care who won elections. The white general election of 1948 matched the ruling United Party, led by General Smuts, then at the height of his international regard, against the revived National Party. While Smuts had enlisted South Africa on the side of the Allies in World War II, the National Party refused to support Great Britain and publicly sympathized with Nazi Germany. The National Party's campaign centered around the Black Danger, and they fought the election on the twin slogans of the nigger in his place and the coolies out of the country, coolies being the Afrikaner's derogatory term for Indians. The nationalists, led by Dr. Daniel Malan, a former minister of the Dutch Reformed Church and a newspaper editor, were a party animated by bitterness. Bitterness toward the English, who had treated them as inferiors for decades, and bitterness toward the African, who the nationalists believed was threatening the prosperity and purity of Afrikaner culture. Africans had no loyalty to General Smuts, but we had even less for the National Party. Malan's platform was known as apartheid. Apartheid was a new term, but an old idea. It literally means apartness, and it represented the codification in one oppressive system of all the laws and regulations that had kept Africans in an inferior position to whites for centuries. What had been more or less de facto was to become relentlessly de jure. The often haphazard segregation of the past 300 years was to be consolidated into a monolithic system that was diabolical in its detail, inescapable in its reach, and overwhelming in its power. The premise of apartheid was that whites were superior to Africans, coloreds, and Indians, and the function of it was to entrench white supremacy forever. As the nationalists put it, the white man must always remain boss. Their platform rested on the term buskap, literally bossship, a freighted word that stood for white supremacy in all its harshness. The policy was supported by the Dutch Reformed Church, which furnished apartheid with its religious underpinnings by suggesting that Afrikaners were God's chosen people and that blacks were a subservient species. In the Afrikaners' worldview, apartheid and the church went hand in hand. The nationalists' victory was the beginning of the end of the domination of the Afrikaner by the Englishman. English would now take second place to Afrikaans as an official language. The nationalist slogan encapsulated their mission. Our own people, our own language, our own land. In the distorted cosmology of the Afrikaner, the nationalist victory was like the Israelites' journey to the Promised Land. This was the fulfillment of God's promise, and the justification for their view that South Africa should be a white man's country forever. The victory was a shock. The United Party and General Smuts had beaten the Nazis, and surely they would defeat the National Party. On election day, I attended a meeting in Johannesburg with Oliver Tambo and several others. We barely discussed the question of a nationalist government because we did not expect one. The meeting went on all night, and we emerged at dawn and found a newspaper vendor selling the Rand Daily Mail. The nationalists had triumphed. I was stunned and dismayed, but Oliver took a more considered line. I like this, he said. I like this. I could not imagine why. He explained, now we will know exactly who our enemies are and where we stand. Even General Smuts realized the dangers of this harsh ideology, decrying apartheid as a crazy concept born of prejudice and fear. From the moment of the nationalists' election, we knew that our land would henceforth be a place of tension and strife. For the first time in South African history, an exclusively Afrikaner party led the government. South Africa belongs to us once more, Malan proclaimed in his victory speech. That same year, the Youth League outlined its policy in a document written by UNDA and issued by the League's Executive Committee. It was a rallying cry to all patriotic youth to overthrow white domination. We rejected the communist notion that Africans were oppressed primarily as an economic class rather than as a race, adding that we needed to create a powerful national liberation movement under the banner of African nationalism and led by Africans themselves. We advocated the redivision of land on an equitable basis, the abolition of color bars prohibiting Africans from doing skilled work, and the need for free and compulsory education. The document also articulated the push and pull between two rival theories of African nationalism, between the more extreme Marcus Garvey-inspired Africa for the Africans nationalism and the Africanism of the Youth League, which recognized that South Africa was a multiracial country. I was sympathetic to the ultra-revolutionary stream of African nationalism. I was angry at the white man, not at racism. While I was not prepared to hurl the white man into the sea, I would have been perfectly happy if he climbed aboard his steamships and left the continent of his own volition. The Youth League was marginally more friendly to the Indians and the coloreds, stating that Indians, like Africans, were oppressed, but that Indians had India, a mother country that they could look to. The coloreds, too, were oppressed, but unlike the Indians, had no mother country except Africa. I was prepared to accept Indians and coloreds provided they accepted our policies, but their interests were not identical with ours, and I was skeptical of whether or not they could truly embrace our cause. In short order, Milan began to implement his pernicious program. Within weeks of coming to power, the nationalist government pardoned Roby Liebrandt, the wartime traitor who had organized uprisings in support of Nazi Germany. The government announced their intention to curb the trade union movement and do away with the limited franchises of the Indian, colored, and African peoples. The Separate Representation of Voters Act eventually robbed the coloreds of their representation in Parliament. The Prohibition of Mixed Marriages Act was introduced in 1949 and was followed in rapid succession by the Immorality Act, making sexual relations between white and non-white illegal. The Population Registration Act labeled all South Africans by race, making color the single most important arbiter of individuals. Milan introduced the Group Areas Act, which he described as the very essence of apartheid, requiring separate urban areas for each racial group. In the past, whites took land by force. Now they secured it by legislation. In response to this new and much more powerful threat from the state, the ANC embarked on an unaccustomed and historic path. In 1949, the ANC launched a landmark effort to turn itself into a truly mass organization. The Youth League drafted a program of action, the cornerstone of which was a campaign of mass mobilization. At the ANC annual conference in Bloemfontein, the organization adopted the League's program of action, which called for boycotts, strikes, stay-at-homes, passive resistance, protest demonstrations, and other forms of mass action. This was a radical change. The ANC's policy had always been to keep its activities within the law. We in the Youth League had seen the failure of legal and constitutional means to strike at racial oppression. Now the entire organization was set to enter a more activist stage. These changes did not come without internal upheaval. A few weeks before the conference, Walter Sisulu, Oliver Tambo, and I met privately with Dr. Tsuma at his home in Sophiatown. We explained that we thought the time had come for mass action along the lines of Gandhi's non-violent protests in India and the 1946 passive resistance campaign asserting that the ANC had become too docile in the face of oppression. The ANC's leaders, we said, had to be willing to violate the law and, if necessary, go to prison for their beliefs, as Gandhi had. Dr. Tsuma was adamantly opposed, claiming that such strategies were premature and would merely give the government an excuse to crush the ANC. Such forms of protest, he said, would eventually take place in South Africa, but at the moment such a step would be fatal. He made it clear that he was a doctor with a wide and prosperous practice that he would not jeopardize by going to prison. We gave Dr. Tsuma an ultimatum. We would support him for re-election to the presidency of the ANC, provided he supported our proposed program of action. If he would not support our program, we would not support him. Dr. Thuma became heated, accusing us of blackmail and laying down conditions on which we would vote for him. He told us that we were young and arrogant and treating him without respect. We remonstrated with him, but to no avail. He would not go along with our proposal. He unceremoniously showed us out of his house at 11 p.m. and closed the gate behind him. There were no street lights in Sophiatown, and it was a moonless night. All forms of public transport had long since ceased, and we lived miles away in Orlando. Oliver remarked that Thuma could have at the very least offered us some transport. Walter was friendly with a family that lived nearby, and we prevailed upon them to take us in for the night. At the conference that December, we in the Youth League knew we had the votes to depose Dr. Thuma. As an alternative candidate, we sponsored Dr. J.S. Moroka for the presidency. He was not our first choice. Professor Z.K. Matthews was the man we wanted to lead us, but Z.K. considered us too radical and our plan of action too impractical. He called us naive firebrands, adding that we would mellow with age. Dr. Moroka was an unlikely choice. He was a member of the All-African Convention, AAC, which was dominated by Trotskyite elements at that time. When he agreed to stand against Dr. Thuma, the Youth League then enrolled him as a member of the ANC. When we first approached him, he consistently referred to the ANC as the African National Council. He was not very knowledgeable about the ANC, nor was he an experienced activist. But he was respectable and amenable to our program. Like Dr. Thuma, he was a doctor and one of the wealthiest black men in South Africa. He had studied at Edinburgh and Vienna. His great-grandfather had been a chief in the Orange Free State and had greeted the Afrikaner voortrekkers of the 19th century with open arms and gifts of land and then been betrayed. Dr. Thuma was defeated and Dr. Moroka became President General of the ANC. Walter Sisulu was elected the new Secretary General, and Oliver Tambo was elected to the National Executive Committee. The program of action approved at the annual conference called for the pursuit of political rights through the use of boycotts, strikes, civil disobedience, and non-cooperation. In addition, it called for a national day of work stoppage in protest against the racist and reactionary policies of the government. This was a departure from the days of decorous protest, and many of the old stalwarts of the ANC were to fade away in this new era of greater militancy. Youth League members had now graduated to the senior organization. We had now guided the ANC to a more radical and revolutionary path. I could only celebrate the Youth League's triumph from a distance, for I was unable to attend the conference myself. I was then working for a new law firm, and they did not give me permission to take 2 days off to attend the conference in Bloemfontein. The firm was a liberal one, but wanted me to concentrate on my work and forget politics. I would have lost my job if I had attended the conference, and I could not afford to do that. The spirit of mass action surged, but I remained skeptical of any action undertaken with the communists and Indians. The Defend Free Speech Convention in March 1950, organized by the Transvaal ANC, the Transvaal Indian Congress, the African People's Organization, and the District Committee of the Communist Party, drew 10,000 people at Johannesburg's Market Square. Dr. Moroka, without consulting the executive, agreed to preside over the convention. The convention was a success, yet I remained wary, as the prime mover behind it was the party. At the instigation of the Communist Party and the Indian Congress, the convention passed a resolution for a one-day general strike known as Freedom Day. on May 1st, calling for the abolition of the pass laws and all discriminatory legislation. Although I supported these objectives, I believed that the communists were trying to steal the thunder from the ANC's National Day of Protest. I opposed the May Day strike on the grounds that the ANC had not originated the campaign, believing that we should concentrate on our own campaign. Ahmed Kathrada was then barely 21 and, like all youth, eager to flex his muscles. He was a key member of the Transvaal Indian Youth Congress and had heard I was opposed to the May Day strike. One day, while walking on Commissioner Street, I met Kathrada and he heatedly confronted me, charging that I and the Youth League did not want to work with Indians or coloreds. In a challenging tone, he said, "You are an African leader and I am an Indian youth, but I am convinced of the support of the African masses for the strike, and I challenge you to nominate any African township for a meeting, and I guarantee the people will support me." It was a hollow threat, but it angered me all the same. I even complained to a joint meeting of the Executive Committee of the ANC, the South African Indian Congress, and the Communist Party. But Ismail Mir calmed me down, saying, "Nelson, he is young and hot-headed. Don't you be the same." I consequently felt a bit sheepish about my actions, and I withdrew the complaint. Although I disagreed with Kathrada, I admired his fire, and it was an incident we came to laugh about. The Freedom Day strike went ahead without official ANC support. In anticipation, the government banned all meetings and gatherings for May 1st. More than two-thirds of African workers stayed at home during the one-day strike. That night, Walter and I were in Orlando West on the fringes of a Freedom Day crowd that had gathered despite the government's restrictions. The moon was bright, and as we watched the orderly march of protesters, we could see a group of policemen camped across a stream about 500 yards away. They must have seen us as well, because all of a sudden they started firing in our direction. We dove to the ground and remained there as mounted police galloped into the crowd, smashing people with batons. We took refuge in a nearby nurse's dormitory, where we heard bullets smashing into the wall of the building. 18 Africans died, and many others were wounded in this indiscriminate and unprovoked attack. Despite protest and criticism, the nationalist response was to tighten the screws of repression. A few weeks later, the government introduced the notorious Suppression of Communism Act, and the ANC called an emergency conference in Johannesburg. The act outlawed the Communist Party of South Africa and made it a crime, punishable by a maximum of 10 years imprisonment, to be a member of the party or to further the aims of communism. But the bill was drafted in such a broad way that it outlawed all but the mildest protest against the state, deeming it a crime to advocate any doctrine that promoted political, industrial, social, or economic change within the Union by the promotion of disturbance or disorder. Essentially, the bill permitted the government to outlaw any organization and to restrict any individual opposed to its policies. The ANC, the SAIC, and the APO again met to discuss these new measures, and Dr. Dadu, among others, said that it would be foolish to allow past differences to thwart a united front against the government. I spoke and echoed his sentiments. Clearly, the repression of any one liberation group was repression against all liberation groups. It was at that meeting that Oliver uttered prophetic words. "Today it is the Communist Party. Tomorrow it will be our trade unions, our Indian Congress, our APO, our African National Congress." Supported by the SAIC and the APO, the ANC resolved to stage a national day of protest on June 26, 1950, against the government's murder of 18 Africans on May 1st and the passage of the Suppression of Communism Act. The proposal was ratified, and in preparation for the day of protest, we closed ranks with the SAIC, the APO, and the Communist Party. Here, I believed, was a sufficient threat that compelled us to join hands with our Indian and Communist colleagues. Earlier that year, I had been co-opted onto the National Executive Committee of the ANC, taking the place of Dr. Tuma, who had resigned after his failure to be re-elected President General. I was not unmindful of the fact that it had been Dr. Tuma who had tried to help me get my first job when I came to Johannesburg 10 years before, when I had no thought of entering politics. Now, as a member of the National Executive Committee, I was playing on the first team with the most senior people in the ANC. I had moved from the role of a gadfly within the organization to one of the powers that I had been rebelling against. It was a heady feeling, and not without mixed emotions. In some ways, it is easier to be a dissident, for then one is without responsibility. As a member of the executive, I had to weigh arguments and make decisions, and expect to be criticized by rebels like myself. Mass action was perilous in South Africa, where it was a criminal offense for an African to strike, and where the rights of free speech and movement were unmercifully curtailed. By striking, an African worker stood not only to lose his job, but his entire livelihood, and his right to stay in the area in which he was living. In my experience, a political strike is always riskier than an economic one. A strike based on a political grievance rather than on clear-cut issues like higher wages or shorter hours is a more precarious form of protest and demands particularly efficient organization. The day of protest was a political rather than an economic strike. In preparation for June 26th, Walter traveled around the country consulting local leaders. In his absence, I took charge of the bustling ANC office, the hub of a complicated national action. Every day, various leaders looked in to see that matters were going according to plan. Moses Katani, Dr. Dadu, Deliza Mji, J.B. Marx, president of the Transvaal ANC, Yusuf Kachalia and his brother Malvi, Gwa Khadebe, Secretary of the Council of Action, Michael Harmel, Peter Raboroko, Ntato Motlana. I was coordinating the actions in different parts of the country and talking by phone with regional leaders. We had left ourselves little time, and the planning was hastily done. The day of protest was the ANC's first attempt to hold a political strike on a national scale, and it was a moderate success. In the cities, the majority of workers stayed home, and black businesses did not open. In Bethel, Gert Sebandi, who later became president of the Transvaal ANC, led a demonstration of 5,000 people, which received headlines in major papers all across the country. The day of protest boosted our morale, made us realize our strength, and sent a warning to the Malan government that we would not remain passive in the face of apartheid. June 26th has since become a landmark day in the freedom struggle, and within the liberation movement it is observed as Freedom Day. It was the first time I had taken a significant part in a national campaign, and I felt the exhilaration that springs from the success of a well-planned battle against the enemy and the sense of comradeship that is born of fighting against formidable odds. The struggle, I was learning, was all-consuming. A man involved in the struggle was a man without a home life. It was in the midst of the day of protest that my second son, Makato Lewanika, was born. I was with Evelyn at the hospital when he came into the world, but it was only a brief respite from my activities. He was named for Sefako Mapoho Makatu, the second president of the ANC from 1917 until 1924, and Lewanika, a leading chief in Zambia. Makatu, the son of a petty chief, had led volunteers to defy the Kalabar that did not permit Africans to walk on the sidewalks of Pretoria, and his name, for me, was an emblem of indomitability and courage. One day, during this same time, my wife informed me that my elder son, Tembi, then 5, had asked her, "Where does Daddy live?" I had been returning home late at night, long after he had gone to sleep, and departing early in the morning before he woke. I did not relish being deprived of the company of my children. I missed them a great deal during those days, long before I had any inkling that I would spend decades apart from them. I was far more certain in those days of what I was against than what I was for. My long-standing opposition to communism was breaking down. Moses Katani, the general secretary of the party and a member of the executive of the ANC, often came to my house late at night and we would debate until morning. Clear-thinking and self-taught, Katani was the son of peasant farmers in the Transvaal. "Nelson," he would say, "what do you have against us? We are all fighting the same enemy. We do not seek to dominate the ANC. We are working within the context of African nationalism." In the end, I had no good response to his arguments. Because of my friendships with Kutani, Ismail Mir, and Ruth First, and my observation of their own sacrifices, I was finding it more and more difficult to justify my prejudice against the party. Within the ANC, party members J.B. Marx, Edwin Mafutsanyana, Dant Lume, and David Bopape, among others, were devoted and hardworking, and left nothing to gainsay as freedom fighters. Dr. Dadu, one of the leaders of the 1946 resistance, was a well-known Marxist whose role as a fighter for human rights had made him a hero to all groups. I could not, and no longer did, question the bona fides of such men and women. If I could not challenge their dedication, I could still question the philosophical and practical underpinnings of Marxism. But I had little knowledge of Marxism, and in political discussions with my communist friends, I found myself handicapped by my ignorance of Marxist philosophy. I decided to remedy this. I acquired the complete works of Marx and Engels, Lenin, Stalin, Mao Zedong, and others, and probed into the philosophy of dialectical and historical materialism. I had little time to study these works properly. While I was stimulated by the Communist Manifesto, I was exhausted by Das Kapital. But I found myself strongly drawn to the idea of a classless society, which, to my mind, was similar to traditional African culture, where life was shared and communal. I subscribed to Marx's basic dictum, which has the simplicity and generosity of the golden rule: from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. Dialectical materialism seemed to offer both a searchlight illuminating the dark night of racial oppression and a tool that could be used to end it. It helped me to see the situation other than through the prism of black and white relations, for if our struggle was to succeed, we had to transcend black and white. I was attracted to the scientific underpinnings of dialectical materialism, for I am always inclined to trust what I can verify. Its materialistic analysis of economics rang true to me. The idea that the value of goods was based on the amount of labor that went into them seemed particularly appropriate for South Africa. The ruling class paid African labor a subsistence wage and then added value to the cost of the goods, which they retained for themselves. Marxism's call to revolutionary action was music to the ears of a freedom fighter. The idea that history progresses through struggle and change occurs in revolutionary jumps was similarly appealing. In my reading of Marxist works, I found a great deal of information that bore on the type of problems that face a practical politician. Marxists gave serious attention to national liberation movements, and the Soviet Union in particular supported the national struggles of many colonial peoples. This was another reason why I amended my view of communists and accepted the ANC position of welcoming Marxists into its ranks. A friend once asked me how I could reconcile my creed of African nationalism with a belief in dialectical materialism. For me, there was no contradiction. I was first and foremost an African nationalist, fighting for our emancipation from minority rule and the right to control our own destiny. But at the same time, South Africa and the African continent were part of the larger world. Our problems, while distinctive and special, were not entirely unique. And a philosophy that placed those problems in an international and historical context of the greater world and the course of history was valuable. I was prepared to use whatever means to speed up the erasure of human prejudice and the end of chauvinistic and violent nationalism. I did not need to become a communist in order to work with them. I found that African nationalists and African communists generally had far more uniting them than dividing them. The cynical have always suggested that the communists were using us. But who is to say that we were not using them? Chapter 14. If we had any hopes or illusions about the National Party before they came into office, we were disabused of them quickly. Their threat to put the Kaffir in his place was not an idle one. Apart from the Suppression of Communism Act, two laws passed in 1950 formed the cornerstones of apartheid, the Population Registration Act and the Group Areas Act. As I have mentioned, the Population Registration Act authorized the government officially to classify all South Africans according to race. If it had not already been so, race became the sine qua non of South African society. The arbitrary and meaningless tests to decide black from colored or colored from white often resulted in tragic cases where members of the same family were classified differently, all depending on whether one child had a lighter or darker complexion. Where one was allowed to live and work could rest on such absurd distinctions as the curl of one's hair or the size of one's lips. The Group Areas Act was the foundation of residential apartheid. Under its regulations, each racial group could own land, occupy premises, and trade only in its own separate area. Indians could henceforth only live in Indian areas, Africans in African, coloreds in colored. If whites wanted the land or houses of the other groups, they could simply declare the land a white area and take them. The Group Areas Act initiated the era of forced removals, when African communities, towns, and villages in the newly designated white urban areas were violently relocated because the nearby white landowners did not want Africans living near them or simply wanted their land. At the top of the list for removal was Sophiatown, a vibrant community of more than 50,000 people, which was one of the oldest black settlements in Johannesburg. Despite its poverty, Sophiatown brimmed with a rich life and was an incubator of so much that was new and valuable in African life and culture. Even before the government's efforts to remove it, Sophiatown held a symbolic importance for Africans disproportionate to its small population. The following year, the government passed two more laws that directly attacked the rights of the coloreds and Africans. The Separate Representation of Voters Act aimed to transfer coloreds to a separate voters' role in the Cape, thereby diluting the franchise rights that they had enjoyed for more than a century. The Bantu Authorities Act abolished the Natives' Representative Council, the one indirect form of national representation for Africans, and replaced it with a hierarchical system of tribal chiefs appointed by the government. The idea was to restore power to traditional and mainly conservative ethnic leaders in order to perpetuate ethnic differences that were beginning to erode. Both laws epitomized the ethos of the nationalist government, which pretended to preserve what they were attempting to destroy. Laws stripping people of their rights were inevitably described as laws restoring those rights. The colored people rallied against the Separate Representation of Voters Act, organizing a tremendous demonstration in Cape Town in March of 1951, and a strike in April that kept shops closed and school children at home. It was in the context of this spirit of activism by Indians, coloreds, and Africans that Walter Sisulu first broached the idea to a small group of us of a national civil disobedience campaign. He outlined a plan under which selected volunteers from all groups would deliberately invite imprisonment by defying certain laws. The idea immediately appealed to me, as it did to the others, but I differed with Walter on the question of who should take part. I had recently become national president of the Youth League, and in my new role I urged that the campaign should be exclusively African. The average African, I said, was still cautious about joint action with Indians and coloreds. While I had made progress in terms of my opposition to communism, I still feared the influence of Indians. In addition, many of our grassroots African supporters saw Indians as exploiters of black labor in their role as shopkeepers and merchants. Walter vehemently disagreed, suggesting that the Indians, coloreds, and Africans were inextricably bound together. The issue was taken up at a meeting of the National Executive Committee, and my view was voted down, even by those who were considered staunch African nationalists. But I was nevertheless persistent, and I raised the matter once more at the National Conference in December 1951, where the delegates dismissed my view as emphatically as the National Executive Committee had done. Now that my view had been rejected by the highest levels of the ANC, I fully accepted the agreed-upon position. While my speech advocating a go-it-alone strategy was met with a lukewarm reception, the speech I gave as president of the Youth League after the League pledged its support for the new policy of cooperation was given a resounding ovation. At the behest of a joint planning council consisting of Dr. Moroka, Walter, J.B. Marx, Yusuf Dadu, and Yusuf Kachalia, the ANC conference endorsed a resolution calling upon the government to repeal the Suppression of Communism Act, the Group Areas Act, the Separate Representation of Voters Act, the Bantu Authorities Act, the Pass Laws, and Stock Limitation Laws by February 29, 1952. The law was intended to reduce overgrazing by cattle, but its impact would be to further abridge land for Africans. The council resolved that the ANC would hold demonstrations on April 6, 1952, as a prelude to the launching of the campaign for the defiance of unjust laws. That same day, white South Africans would be celebrating the 300th anniversary of Jan van Riebeck's arrival at the Cape in 1652. April 6 is the day white South Africans annually commemorate as the founding of their country, and Africans revile as the beginning of 300 years of enslavement. The ANC drafted a letter to the Prime Minister advising him of these resolutions and the deadline for repealing the laws. Because the letter was to go out under the name of Dr. Moroka, and Dr. Moroka had not participated in the writing of it, I was instructed to take him the letter by driving to his home in Thaba Nchu, a town near Bloemfontein in the Orange Free State, a very conservative area of the country. I almost did not make it there to see him. Only a few weeks before, I had taken my driver's test. In those days, a driver's license was an unusual thing for an African, for very few blacks had cars. On the appointed day, I borrowed a car to use for the test. I was a bit cocky and decided to drive the car there myself. I was running late and was driving faster than I should have been, and as I maneuvered the car along a side street that met a main road, I failed to look both ways and collided with a car coming in another direction. The damage was minimal, but now I would certainly be late. The other driver was a reasonable fellow, and we simply agreed to pay our own expenses. When I reached the testing station, I observed a white woman ahead of me in the middle of her test. She was driving properly and cautiously. When the test was finished, the driving inspector said, "Thank you. Would you please park the car over there?" gesturing to a space nearby. She had performed the test well enough to pass, but as the woman drove over to the parking place, she did not negotiate a corner properly, and the back wheel jumped the curb. The inspector hurried over and said, "I'm sorry, madam, you failed the test. Please make another appointment." I felt my confidence ebbing. If this fellow tricks a white woman into failing her test, what hope would I have? But I performed well on the test, and when the inspector told me to park the car at the end of the exam, I drove so carefully that I thought he might penalize me for going too slowly. Once I could legally drive, I became a one-man taxi service. It was one's obligation to give rides to comrades and friends. I was thus deputized to take the letter to Dr. Marocca. This was no hardship to me, as I have always found it enjoyable to gaze out the window while driving. I seem to have my best ideas while driving through the countryside, with the wind whipping through the window. On my way down to Thaba Nchu, I passed through Kroonstad, a conservative free state town about 120 miles south of Johannesburg. I was driving up a hill and saw two white boys ahead of me on bicycles. My driving was still a bit unsteady, and I came too close to the boys, one of whom suddenly made a turn without signaling, and we collided. He was knocked off his bicycle and was groaning when I got out of the car to help him. He had his arms out, signaling for me to pick him up, but just as I was about to do so, a white truck driver yelled for me not to touch the boy. The truck driver scared the child, who then dropped his arms as though he did not want me to pick him up. The boy was not badly hurt, and the truck driver took him to the police station, which was close by. The local police arrived a short time later, and the white sergeant took one look at me and said, "Kefa, you will shit today." I was shaken by the accident and the violence of his words, but I told him in no uncertain terms that I would shit when I pleased, not when a policeman told me to. At this, the sergeant took out his notebook to record my particulars. Afrikaans policemen were surprised if a black man could speak English, much less answer back. After I identified myself, he turned to the car, which he proceeded to ransack. From under the floor mat, he pulled out a copy of the left-wing weekly, The Guardian, which I had hidden immediately after the accident. I had slipped the letter for Dr. Marocca inside my shirt. He looked at the title and then held it up in the air like a pirate with his booty. He cried, "My word, we've caught a communist!" Brandishing the newspaper, he hurried off. The sergeant returned after about 4 hours, accompanied by another officer. This sergeant, while also an Afrikaner, was intent on doing his duty correctly. He said he would need to take measurements at the site of the accident for police records. I told the sergeant that it was not proper to take the measurements at night when the accident had occurred in the daylight. I added that I intended to spend the night in Thaba Nchu, and that I could not afford to stay in Kroonstad. The sergeant eyed me impatiently and said, "What is your name?" "Mandela," I said. "No, the first one," he said. I told him. "Nelson," the sergeant said, as if he were talking to a boy. "I want to help you resume your journey, but if you are going to be difficult with me, I will have no alternative but to be difficult with you and lock you up for the night." That brought me down to earth, and I consented to the measurements. I resumed my journey late that night, and the next morning I was traveling through the district of Excelsior when my car ground to a halt. I had run out of petrol. I walked to a nearby farmhouse and explained in English to an elderly white lady that I would like to buy some petrol. As she was closing the door, she said, "I don't have any petrol for you." I tramped 2 miles to the next farm and, chastened by my unsuccessful first effort, tried a different approach. I asked to see the farmer, and when he appeared, I assumed a humble demeanor. My boss has run out of petrol, I said. Boss, the Afrikaans word for boss or master, signifies subservience. Friendly and helpful, the farmer was a relation of Prime Minister Strydom. Yet I believe he would have given me the petrol had I told him the truth and not used the hated word boss. The meeting with Dr. Moroka proved far less eventful than my journey there. He approved of the letter, and I made my way back to Johannesburg without incident. The letter to the Prime Minister noted that the ANC had exhausted every constitutional means at our disposal to achieve our legitimate rights, and that we demanded the repeal of the 6 unjust laws by February 29, 1952, or else we would take extra constitutional action. Milan's reply, signed by his private secretary, asserted that whites had an inherent right to take measures to preserve their own identity as a separate community, and ended with the threat that if we pursued our actions, the government would not hesitate to make full use of its machinery to quell any disturbances. We regarded Milan's curt dismissal of our demands as a declaration of war. We now had no alternative but to resort to civil disobedience, and we embarked on preparations for mass action in earnest. The recruitment and training of volunteers was one of the essential tasks of the campaign, and would in large part be responsible for its success or failure. On April 6th, preliminary demonstrations took place in Johannesburg, Pretoria, Port Elizabeth, Durban, and Cape Town. While Dr. Moroka addressed a crowd at Freedom Square in Johannesburg, I spoke to a group of potential volunteers at the Garment Workers Union. I explained to a group of several hundred Africans, Indians, and coloreds that volunteering was a difficult and even dangerous duty, as the authorities would seek to intimidate, imprison, and perhaps attack the volunteers. No matter what the authorities did, the volunteers could not retaliate. Otherwise, they would undermine the value of the entire enterprise. They must respond to violence with non-violence. Discipline must be maintained at all cost. On May 31st, the executives of the ANC and the SAIC met in Port Elizabeth and announced that the Defiance campaign would begin on June 26th, the anniversary of the first National Day of Protest. They also created a National Action Committee to direct the campaign and a National Volunteer Board to recruit and train volunteers. I was appointed National Volunteer-in-Chief of the campaign and chairman of both the Action Committee and the Volunteer Board. My responsibilities were to organize the campaign, coordinate the regional branches, canvass for volunteers, and raise funds. We also discussed whether the campaign should follow Gandhian principles of nonviolence, or what the Mahatma called Satyagraha, a nonviolence that seeks to conquer through conversion. Some argued for nonviolence on purely ethical grounds, saying it was morally superior to any other method. This idea was strongly affirmed by Manilal Gandhi, the Mahatma's son and the editor of the newspaper Indian Opinion, who was a prominent member of the SAIC. With his gentle demeanor, Gandhi seemed the very personification of nonviolence, and he insisted that the campaign be run along identical lines to that of his father's in India. Others said that we should approach this issue not from the point of view of principles, but of tactics, and that we should employ the method demanded by the conditions. If a particular method or tactic enabled us to defeat the enemy, then it should be used. In this case, the state was far more powerful than we, and any attempts at violence by us would be devastatingly crushed. This made nonviolence a practical necessity rather than an option. This was my view, and I saw nonviolence in the Gandhian model not as an inviolable principle, but as a tactic to be used as the situation demanded. The principle was not so important that the strategy should be used even when it was self-defeating, as Gandhi himself believed. I called for nonviolent protest for as long as it was effective. this view prevailed, despite Manilal Gandhi's strong objections. The Joint Planning Council agreed upon an open-ended program of non-cooperation and non-violence. Two stages of defiance were proposed. In the first stage, a small number of well-trained volunteers would break selected laws in a handful of urban areas. They would enter proscribed areas without permits, use whites-only facilities such as toilets, whites-only railway compartments, waiting rooms, and post office entrances. They would deliberately remain in town after curfew. Each batch of defiers would have a leader who would inform the police in advance of the act of disobedience so that the arrests could take place with a minimum of disturbance. The second stage was envisioned as mass defiance, accompanied by strikes and industrial actions across the country. Prior to the inauguration of the defiance campaign, a rally called the Day of the Volunteers was held in Durban on June 22nd. Chief Luthuli, president of the Natal ANC, and Dr. Naker, president of the Natal Indian Congress, both spoke and committed themselves to the campaign. I had driven down the day before and was the main speaker. About 10,000 people were in attendance, and I told the crowd that the defiance campaign would be the most powerful action ever undertaken by the oppressed masses in South Africa. I had never addressed such a great crowd before, and it was an exhilarating experience. One cannot speak to a mass of people as one addresses an audience of 24. Yet I have always tried to take the same care to explain matters to great audiences as to small ones. I told the people that they would make history and focus the attention of the world on the racist policies of South Africa. I emphasized that unity among the black people, Africans, coloreds, and Indians in South Africa had at last become a reality. All across the country, those who defied on June 26th did so with courage, enthusiasm, and a sense of history. The campaign began in the early morning hours in Port Elizabeth, where 33 defiers, under the leadership of Raymond Mhlaba, entered a railway station through a whites-only entrance and were arrested. They marched in singing freedom songs to the accompanying cheers of friends and family. In a call and response, the defiers and the crowd yelled, "Let Africa come back!" On the morning of the 26th, I was in the ANC office overseeing the day's demonstrations. The Transvaal batch of volunteers was scheduled to go into action at midday at an African township near Boksburg, east of Johannesburg. Led by Reverend N.B. Tuntz, they were to court arrest by entering the township without permission. Reverend Tuntz was an elderly fellow, a minister in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and the acting president of the Transvaal ANC. It was late morning, and I was waiting for Reverend Tuntz to arrive from Pretoria, when he telephoned me at the office. With regret in his voice, he told me that his doctor advised him against defying and going to prison. I assured him that we would provide him with warm clothing and that he would spend only a night in jail, but to no avail. This was a grave disappointment, for Reverend Tuntz was a distinguished figure and had been selected in order to show the authorities that we were not just a group of young rabble-rousers. In place of Reverend Tuntz, we quickly found someone equally venerable, Nana Sita, the president of the Transvaal Indian Congress, who had served a month in jail for his passive resistance during the 1946 protest campaign. Despite his advanced age and acute arthritis, Sita was a fighter and agreed to lead our defiers. In the afternoon, as we were preparing to go to Boksburg, I realized that the secretary of the Transvaal branch of the ANC was nowhere to be found. He was meant to accompany Nana Sita to Boksburg. This was another crisis, and I turned to Walter and said, "You must go." This was our first event in the Transvaal, and it was necessary to have prominent figures lead the defiers. Otherwise, the leaders would appear to be hanging back while the masses took the punishment. Even though Walter was one of the organizers and was scheduled to defy later, he readily agreed.
My main concern was that he was wearing a suit, impractical dress for prison. But we managed to find him some old clothes instead. We then left for Boksburg, where Yusuf Kachalia and I planned to deliver a letter to the Boksburg magistrate, advising him that 50 of our volunteers would enter the African township in his area that day without permits. When we arrived at the magistrate's office, we found a large contingent of press